This is Ron Orl, and you're listening to the Activist Investing Today podcast. And I'm super excited to be speaking here today with Ellie Klein, partner at Schulte, Roth & Zabel. Klein is the chair of the M&A and Securities Group, and he's also the co-chair of the Global Shareholder Activism Group and serves as a member of the firm's executive committee. And he has a who's who of activist investor clients. And I'm just going to go through some of the most high profile of them. Engine number one, the ESG activist, which everyone knows, succeeded in its David versus Goliath ESG director contest against ExxonMobil. Klein has worked with Elliott Management, Jana Partners, Sevian, and Starboard Valley. So lots of different activist investors. Welcome, Ellie. Thank you for taking the time.
Always great to be with you on anything, Ron. So thanks for the opportunity.
Okay, cool. So I wanted to start off with an unusual activist situation that has made a lot of headlines in a lot of different publications lately, but I feel like some of them are missing some of the nuances. So I thought maybe we could get through it. And that's, of course, the richest man in the world, Elon Musk, filed a 13G on Monday. You know, this is the passive filing at Twitter, showing out of nowhere that he became the largest shareholder of Twitter with 9.2%. Then he followed it up on April 5th. There was an April 5th agreement Twitter put out in an 8K to put Musk, who is a vocal Twitter critic, on the social media giant's board. Shortly before the April 5th agreement, Musk tweeted one of his polls. He often does these polls raising concerns, and he asked Twitter followers, millions of whom responded, whether they would like an edit option on Twitter to edit their tweets if they spelled something wrong or something to that effect. And then much later on the same day, April 5th, he filed a 13D, the kind of an activist type filing, reporting his agreement to get on the board. And interestingly, it limited him from buying any more than 14.9% of Twitter. Remember, he owns 9.2%. So we all know that Elon Musk has played fast and loose with SEC rules in the past. He obviously was in discussions with Twitter in advance of his April 4th 13G passive investment filing. And even the agreement on the 5th said that the agreement was actually reached on the 4th, but it was just disclosed on the 5th. So I don't know, Ellie, maybe you could make some sense of this. Do you feel, I know the 13Gs, there's a lot of discretion to postpone the disclosure of 13Gs, at least now. There may be some changes we could talk about later. But then he filed the D, you know, pretty quickly after he signed the agreement to be on the board. So I don't know, do you feel like he should have put it out originally as a D since he had an agreement the next day to get on the board of Twitter?
No, we only know what's public. We don't know what's not public. So it's hard to give conclusive answers as to what he should or shouldn't have done. There's no question that from the outside, it doesn't look like a very conservative position that he took. So just running through it, the 13G he filed, the SEC does have a proposal to shorten that time frame from 10 calendar days to 5 calendar days, but he filed under the 13D1C, which means he had to file within 10 calendar days of crossing 5%. We see a 60-day trading history in his 13D. So he crossed on March 14th, which was the date he put on the cover of his 13G. He didn't file the 13G till 11 days late. I mean, he had to file by March 24th, and he didn't file it until April 4th. So it was 11 days late. It was missing a certification of passivity, which is required for 13D1C filers in the form. He just said not applicable. And a minor point, the numbers changed with no obviously trading between the 13G and the 13D by a slight amount. So there's clearly something wrong with the 13G that was filed. And I know a lot of people are talking about the fact that at least in those 11 days after he had to file the 13G, people were trading at what seems to be a false price because once he filed it, the stock jumped tremendously. So there are definitely issues. Whether the issues the SEC is willing to examine just on those points, who knows? And definitely, if you're in discussions about having a board seat, it'd be very aggressive to not file 13D initially. But we don't know from the outside exactly what happened. Is there discussions, a light discussion? Was he walking a line? Did they not have any real substantive conversations till later, other than loose conversations? Truth is, we don't know. So definitely from the outside, there seems some issues. We can't know for certain, other than the fact of the points I pointed out that were incorrect on the 13G, what, if anything, was wrong. And we don't know what the SEC's interest is going to be in looking into this and pursuing. Obviously, they have been involved with Elon, and therefore they may be interested or they may have other things to deal with.
Well, I was wondering whether we might see he clearly has had issues with the SEC in the past. And I was envisioning that without consulting advisors, he might tweet, buying Twitter, funding secured, We never saw that tweet. So,
well, that would definitely raise more issues.
Yeah. Okay. Well, anyways, it's interesting to see that one day after the G was filed, he got on the board and then he filed the D. Yeah, it's definitely very interesting. So, okay, we have a bunch of other subjects I wanted to get through and not a lot of time. And I guess what, you know, some of the biggest issues are taking place at the Securities and Exchange Commission, where Gary Gensler introduced a barrage of new disclosure proposals. We'll see if all of them or some of them get adopted. A lot of shareholder proposals historically have never been adopted, but it seems like almost weekly there's some sort of disclosure proposal introduced. And a lot of them are affecting active investors. And one in particular that I wrote a story about recently, looking at all the comment letters, basically focuses on a new Form 10B1, which would require investors that own derivatives exceeding 300 million, that's one of the thresholds, have to disclose their positions. And they would need to disclose it within one business day of breaching this limit. And like you mentioned earlier, Ellie, you know, there are other limits and thresholds. You know, when you cross the 5% threshold, you have to file a 13D within, and you have an activist intent, you have to file a 13D within 10 days of crossing it. Now the SEC is also considering shortening that to 5 days. But this derivatives proposal, you know, was originally introduced as part of a broader push to try to protect market integrity from systemic risk following the collapse last year of that private investment firm, Archegos Capital. But I feel like it has this kind of unintended consequence of impacting activists, particularly those that use a lot of investments in derivatives, cash-settled equity swaps. So, Ellie, maybe you could kind of walk us through, how do you think this might affect activist investors if it is adopted?
Yeah, we can talk about that. I think you mentioned that there really are these two proposals that, to a large extent, work hand in hand, particularly in the activist domain. So you have the 10B1 proposal you're talking about on cash-settled swaps and other derivatives. And you also have the 13D amendments, which will pick up certain other cash-settled derivatives that aren't picked up by 10B1. So they work hand in hand in terms of how they can affect the marketplace. And two things I'll point out as an initial matter. One is the fact that it really depends on where you are in the marketplace in terms of what you're going after. So a lot of activism, and remember, activism at its core is identifying underperforming companies by some metric and trying to improve them. And when you take the toehold in that, there's different ways you can do it economically through derivatives and or through actual ownership of the stock. Depending upon the size of the company, and a lot of the companies in the activism space are on the smaller end of the spectrum of capitalization. So if you're looking at the $1 billion type companies, the proposal on 10B1 for swap disclosure presumably is not going to have that much effect on that, because crossing a $300 million threshold is quite a bit of stock or exposure to stock that you'd have to get in a $1 billion company. Frankly, it's a lot of exposure to get to $5 billion company. So it's really not going to affect that part of the market, the swap disclosure by itself, because it's not going to be something that's going to be tripped very often.
What about more like an AT&T type, you know, large cap? Right.
So that will affect large cap. And the flip side, which is why I put them together, the 13D stuff may affect it earlier in terms of what you do if you're buying stock, because in small companies, you hit that threshold sooner. So that's why they work hand in hand. And people always try to manage in terms of disclosure. There's a number of reasons why disclosure may not be wanted. It could be that you're trying to not trip HSR thresholds because you have to wait 30 days after you file. And it's quite a lead time before you're able to buy stock. So that's one thing you're trying to manage around. It could be very practical. You don't want the company or the marketplace to really get a sense of what you're doing. And one of the criticisms that you're seeing already, and you'll see more in the 13D comments as they finish up next week, is that the big issue here is that this is proprietary information and analysis that's being done by investors. And the sooner this information gets out, the sooner the market can piggyback and get on board with what the investor has done as the sole work, which they're entitled to their own work product. Mm-hmm. And this is really the biggest problem, is that the reason why you're trying to avoid publicity frequently is because you don't want to give other people who haven't done the work the fact of looking at a very prominent, reputable, good reputation like an Elliott and say, oh, if Elliott thinks it's good, I don't have to think about it. I'll just jump on and see what happens. So that's not fair to the activists of the world, the Star Wars, the Elliots, the other ones. Why should they have to share their information before they're required to?
So this is an issue. This is an issue of herding, kind of, that the activists, when they disclose.
The big issue that the SEC hasn't taken into account. So it will affect to some extent how that's done, because if it's on the bigger companies, like you're saying, the 10b-1 swap disclosure could kick in very early and alert companies. Maybe it's avoidable by just buying stock, and then therefore it's going to affect the 13s, is going to affect smaller companies. And that's why I keep marrying them, because you have two things you can move, which is the stock ownership and the swap ownership. But it's sometimes hard to manage both. So your example, let's say in AT&T, you may have HSR thresholds and you have to wait, is it over a month when you add on the filing preparation time. And that seems to be unnecessary. So you may be building a swap position while you're doing that. And the disclosure may out you, so to speak, early. And that's really not fair to the investing world.
So, I mean, the issue is that when a well-known reputable activist has their position disclosed, other shareholders jump in afterwards, and that raises the price to a cost that makes it difficult, maybe prohibitively difficult, for the activist to accumulate the position that they need. They feel they need to cover the cost to, you know, that they're hoping to make money with their campaign and all their effort that they're putting in. And so they may not decide in the first place to accumulate, to invest there, and then ultimately launch a campaign or effort at the company if they had to disclose it earlier.
That's right. In fact, Elliot is part of the 10b-1 proposal, put in a really well thought and brilliant piece on the comment letter, where they included actual concrete statistics backing up what you just said, how stock moves on the becoming public, that they are in the name. So there's no question, there's evidence that that happens, and therefore it's truly unfair to them that their information has to be disclosed earlier than it should have to be disclosed. There are rules, and they adhere to them, and as everyone else does. But if you're going to change the dynamics, it's just not going to be worth it for investors to make their investments and do the research. Why would they do it?
Okay, so I went through a lot of these comment letters. At least I haven't gone through the 13D ones yet, but I went through the derivative disclosure ones. And, you know, there was a lot of academics, a surprisingly group of academics that include some members that I considered to be more anti-activist, let's say, or against the activism world, actually worked together with the kind of more pro-activist academics and submitted comments saying that this was a bad proposal and it should never be adopted. And but this group of 81 academics wrote this one comment letter where they had suggested, you know, they acknowledged that the collapse of Archegos was a big problem, and that the SEC should have more information about derivatives, and, you know, if a large, let's say, family office like Archegos accumulated lots of different huge derivative positions in a particular company with different banks, you know, maybe they could have limited that from happening. So anyways, they acknowledge, I mean, the letter is mostly about how they think this is bad for activism and all the reasons you just went over, but they came up with some sort of compromise idea. And I've seen this in a few other comment letters as well. Maybe those derivative disclosures should be provided privately to the SEC. So at least they have a better handle on whether a particular investor, he has massive investments in a particular company through a variety of different derivatives investments. I don't know. Does that seem like a possibly a good idea?
It's a good suggestion, depending upon what the SEC really needs. I mean, the concern whenever you're just providing information to the SEC, and particularly on a very quick basis, and particularly when it's a lot of it, is are they going to have the ability to actually look at it and make use of it? That may argue towards really thinking about what the purpose of the rule is. I mean, just taking a step back, remember, you can appreciate where Gensler wants to come out of these things. He likes visibility, thinks that's good, and that's admirable. I don't think that this sentiment can be criticized at all. It's very good what he's trying to do in that sense. But there's a cost to it, and it has to be applied judiciously and has to be applied thoughtfully, and the cost-benefit analysis has to justify it. And I think these are examples where it's not clear, or on the contrary, I think it is clear that the cost-benefit analysis does not justify these types of rules, both on 13D and 10B1. That's the problem. So is it a potential thing that the SEC at least wants to make sure they get the information that they'll take privately? Yeah, I think it is. I think it should be a little bit more measured, not one day type thing, but let it come in, and that is a possibility. But I actually think that they should take a step back. We appreciate the sentiment and really think about the comments and how thoughtful and detailed they were and the issues that they raised that they may have not fully appreciated. And to me, the better answer is these things are just not worth it and not important enough to justify this type of regulation.
Okay. And then just one of the points you talked about is the HSR disclosure. And that's obviously when you buy common shares. And I feel like when you're kind of a Carl Icahn, targeting a larger company, then these HSR filings become important. So maybe walk us through that. These are kind of private filings initially, I guess, that go to companies. And so the company is aware that the activist is accumulating. Why is it a problem to trigger these HSR filings from an activist point of view?
Well, we talked about the fact that there's their herding mentality, which you mentioned earlier.
Right.
When people see your name, you also have another aspect, which is as you're building a position, a strategic determination is when's the right time to approach a company. That's going to have a lot of factors. Where's the company in terms of the calendar? Where's the company in terms of their approach and what they're doing? And you're trying to find the best time to do it. You don't want the tail wagging the dog and having to have things that have nothing to do with the fundamentals of what the thesis of investment is about, requiring it to do things earlier than you would otherwise. So the HSR filing goes to both the FTC and DOJ on the government side, but also goes to the company because they have to respond to it. So it lets them know that something's up, maybe before you're ready to tell them, maybe before your thesis is fully baked, maybe before you fully have put together all the pieces as you're building. You've gotten to the point where you're willing to build the economics, but it may be premature to start engaging with the company until more things happen, until what you see, whether it's worthwhile. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, a lot of things don't get pursued, even though they're initially invested in. There's many examples publicly out there where people have taken positions and ultimately, based upon time and how it plays out with the calendar, they actually don't pursue it. It just becomes an investment. This is going to be the tail wagging the dog, because if you have to file earlier, that's another example of where the company is going to react and perhaps do things that are rash and not in the best interest of anyone, and definitely not where the investment thesis is going, based upon an HSR filing. So that has part to do with what's going on in the mix out there.
Right. And I feel like the HSR filings is one of the reasons why the activists have in recent years shifted to the derivatives, but now the derivatives have to be disclosed earlier, then there's nowhere to go kind of thing. So anyways, it'll be just to see how this plays out. I wanted to shift gears a little bit. At the beginning of our conversation, I mentioned that Ellie and the Schulte Rothby team advise Engine Number One in its very big ESG win at ExxonMobil and getting three directors elected to the board at Exxon. So obviously ESG is becoming a bigger and bigger factor in traditional activism, with hedge fund activists, the ones usually pushing for operational changes, M&A type changes, launching campaigns with an ESG, that's of course the ESG stands for environment, social, governance, investing focus, or part of their focus is on these topics. And so I have to ask you, I'm seeing a lot of these activist hedge funds launch these ESG campaigns in tandem with more traditional campaigns. I guess the most high profile example of this is Carl Icahn has two director contests up at both McDonald's and Kroger's, the grocery store chain, over the treatment of pig and animal welfare. And he also has a huge proxy contest seeking to take over the board of Southwest Gas. And he is seeking to buy Southwest Gas for roughly $5 billion. So that's obviously the more traditional Carl Icahn kind of hostile takeover slash proxy contest. And then the McDonald's and Kroger's are part of this new ESG kind of strategy. And, you know, I'm not saying Carl Icahn isn't genuine in his concern for pigs at McDonald's and Kroger's distribution, but I'm just wondering if those contests could help his branding effort with his Southwest Gas bid, and whether, maybe I'm being a little cynical, that's part of the strategy here. And, you know, one of the things I looked up was the largest investors in both McDonald's and Kroger's and at Southwest Gas, among the top 5-10 holders, are the big index funds, BlackRock, State Street, Vanguard. And these big index funds are trying to become more ESG friendly. And we saw them supporting to a certain extent that Engine Number One contest at ExxonMobil, for example. So anyways, I don't know. What do you think about this, Ellie? I know maybe I'm putting you a little bit of a tough spot with this, but are the index funds looking at the Southwest Gas situation where they're being offered $82.50 a share from Carl Icahn in isolation, or is all this thought about together where they're looking at the ESG campaigns at Kroger and McDonald's while they're trying to think about what they want to do with Southwest Gas?
It's an interesting point you're making. I think it's very creative in terms of how to think about it. And the answer is, who knows ultimately what the answer is. Just breaking it down from two sides of this one. One, I think that the big institutional index funds are predominantly making decisions based on fundamentals of each company. You know, they are human beings. They are influenced, of course, by things that are going on more broadly. And maybe to the extent there's neutrality, they can be pushed one way or the other. But I imagine in Southwest Gas, yes, they're going to make the decision based upon the fundamentals of that deal and not based upon anything else.
you know, but it, again, they are human beings, and to the extent that they're neutral, maybe they do get influenced by broader things. The second thing on the flip side is Carl Icahn has been at this game a long, long time. He's one of the most iconic ones in the space. And I don't know that he needs to do anything with his reputation at this stage. It's a well of decades established reputation. I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt, though, again, I can't deny there's more to it, that based upon this, it's public, his interest of his daughter in some of these issues, and the fact that he doesn't have really any economics in the Kroger's and McDonald's situations, that he's doing it for pure social reasons. And I'll give him credit for that. Again, I'm not denying that it doesn't hurt his brand, but I'm not going to say that's driving it. And again, I don't think he really has to develop his brand after decades of it being what it is. But I'm not disagreeing. It can't hurt.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, I mean, I agree that it appears to be altruistic what he's doing. And that's a good point you make, Elliot, that he owns very few shares. I think 200 shares in McDonald's and like 0.1 or some tiny stake in Kroger's. And he has to spend a lot of money, presumably, if he really wants to win this proxy contest. To win a proxy contest, you could spend hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars on all the different advisors, right?
You can. I mean, he has a captive team, and he's able to do things more economically than others. But no, the question, he has to spend money. And I imagine the amount of money he's going to spend is going to be a significant multiple of the amount of money he has invested. So I'm giving him the benefit of doing it for social reasons. But I'm not denying that it does help whenever you can do something that's considered good for society.
Okay. So just to wrap things up here, I appreciate you taking the time, LA. Really enjoyed this conversation. ESG, I mean, do you think we're going to see more ESG-focused activism where you see the hedge fund activists or even other types of investors seeking to elect directors with ESG goals in mind? And, you know, there could be an economic aspect of it. A lot of people talked about Engine Number One's campaign at Exxon had a broader long-term economic goal, and the environmental approach to it was tied together with that longer term economic goal, you know, thinking that they were, for example, spending too much money on risky oil investments. I mean, do you think we'll see more ESG activism? And I'm not just talking about the show proposals. I'm talking about the activism that we've seen historically, the Elliots and the Starboards, where they're nominating directors and trying to press for changes at companies.
Yeah, no, I do think you'll see more of it. I don't think it's ready to dominate the general activist space, but financial players are seeing, and I think this is a win-win for everyone, for society and the like, they're seeing the economic benefits of making investment and pushing for ESG changes. You used ExxonMobil as an example. That definitely had fundamental traditional underperformance metrics in play there, but also did have a very important long-term environmental component and climate component. So you're going to see more of that. I think you're going to see the S part, the social part, also catch up with environmental. So I think environmental is a little ahead. Governance has been there for years. Mm-hmm. Diversity issues are gaining traction. So I think you're going to see more and more of that. You still are going to see most of it happening with some traditional overlay. Because ultimately, going back to where we started in other contexts, you got to make money to have the ability to put this in play. There are plenty of people who do this sort of on a nonprofit basis. I'm not talking about those, but people who have investors and are trying to do something, I say it's a win-win because if they can find a way to make money and help improve ESG and other things that are important to society, I think that's great. So I do think you're going to see more of it. I think there's going to be a lot of combinations with traditional underperformance metrics. But you're going to see more, and I think you're going to see the S part catch up slowly.
Okay. Thank you, Ellie. So this has been the Activist Investing Today podcast, and we've been speaking to Ellie Klein, chair of the M&A and Securities Group and the Global Shareholder Activism Group at Schulte, Roth & Zabel. Thank you, Ellie, for taking the time.
My pleasure. It's always good to be with you on anything, Ron.